リスナーの皆さん、残念ながらこれで1時間をもう経ちました。最後までお聞きくださりありがとうございます。次は英語の1時間番組を送ります。皆さん、ボイスオブインドネシアのソーシャルメディアアカウントをフォローすることも忘れないでください。 Facebook は The Voice of Indonesia、 Instagram は VOI underscore underscore official、 TikTok はVOI underscore underscore official、 YouTube は VOI official。 あなたも LRE デジタルアプリで Voice of Indonesia の放送を聞くこともできます。そして受信報告書はメールで voilisteners@gmail.com に送られることができます。それではまた次回お会いしましょう。Listener, thank you for still staying tuned in Indonesia today through our audio streaming voinews.id and RRI Digital. I'm Nuka Kusumawati and I will accompany you to complete your weekend with highlight of the week. Let's begin with the first info where Indonesia's target zero accident in tourist destination. Indonesian Minister of Tourism Widianti Putri Wardana expressed her condolences to the family of Juliana Marins, a tourist from Brazil who was caught in an accident while hiking Mount Rinjani last Saturday. In a press conference held after inspecting preparation at Taman Mini Indonesia Indah for the upcoming school holiday period in Jakarta on Tuesday, she stressed that the safety and security of tourists are top priorities in the development of national tourism. Widianti called on all relevant agencies to strengthen tourism operational standards and increase vigilance regarding high-risk activities, particularly at extreme destinations such as Mount Rinjani. She expressed hope that this would be the last such incident, emphasizing that the government is targeting zero accident at all tourist destinations in Indonesia.
We sincerely hope this will be the last incident. We are targeting zero accidents at all tourist destinations in Indonesia. Even a single incident can greatly affect the image of our tourism in the eyes of the world.
The minister further urged all tourism ecosystem stakeholders to treat safety and security as a shared commitment. She also stated, based on the latest report from the National Search and Rescue Agency, the victim was located approximately 400 meters below the initial fall point and is presumed to be deceased. She added that the government is continuing to communicate with the victim's family and the Brazilian embassy to provide accurate and transparent information. Next, we have information about increase in domestic tourist movements expected to have a positive impact on the hotel and MSMEs industries. Indonesian Minister of Tourism Widianti Putri Wardana announced that the government has provided discount on transportation tickets and toll roads fees as part of domestic consumption based stimulus package to boost the movement of domestic tourists during this year's school holiday season. She made the statement during a press conference after inspecting the preparation for the school holidays in Jakarta on Tuesday. As part of supports for the stimulus program, she explained that the Ministry of Tourism is also promoting the hashtag The Indonesia Aja or Holiday in Indonesia Only campaign.
With this campaign, we hope to see an increase in the number of domestic tourist trips and encourage people to travel within Indonesia. We expect higher travel activity during this year's school holidays, and we hope that the hotel industry and MSMEs will benefit positively from this momentum.
Meanwhile, in the same event, Deputy for Destination and Infrastructure Development at the Ministry of Tourism, Haryanto, express optimism that the target of 1.08 billion domestic tourist movement can be achieved this year, noting that around 282 million movements were recorded in the first quarter alone. He added that given the conducive condition during the school holidays, the target is likely to be reached. Now we have information about President Support Strategy Collaboration between government and PBNU. Yahya Khalil Stakuf, chairman of the executive board of the biggest Islamic organization in Indonesia, Nahdlatul Ulama, reported to President Prabowo Subianto the progress of various memorandums of understanding or MOUs between the board and several ministries and government agencies. One of the collaborations discussed is related to the government's latest free nutritious meal programs. He disclosed this after meeting the president at the Merdeka Palace in Jakarta on Tuesday.
We reported that MOUs with various ministries and government bodies. As for the free nutritious meals program, we have already started it in several locations, and now it is progressing rapidly in its development. Hopefully, it will run more smoothly.
Yahya Stakuf also reported the progress of other social programs, including the NU Prosperous Family Movement, which has been carried out in collaboration with various ministries. These programs aims to improve the overall welfare of the people. He claimed that President Prabowo welcomed all the initiative presented and expressed his full support for strengthening the collaboration between Nahdlatul Ulama and the government. Let's move on to our next info, where Head of National Nutrition Agency's SPPG continues serving mothers and toddlers during school holidays. Head of the Indonesian National Nutrition Agency, Dadan Hindayana, emphasized that the Nutrition Service Unit will continue operating during school holidays to support the free nutritious meals programs. He made the statement after delivering Tuesday, June 24th.
But if there are no students in the area and teachers are not willing to come to school, then the nutritious meal program for students will temporarily stop during the school break. However, don't forget that every nutrition service unit still serves pregnant women, breastfeeding mothers and toddlers, and this service does not take a holiday.
He stressed that the Nutrition Service Unit will continue to play a key role in the national nutrition intervention, including during school holidays. The program acceleration phase is scheduled for late July through August, after personnel training and nationwide deployment are completed, with a focus on underdeveloped remote and outermost regions. Our next info is about President Prabowo expressed his appreciation to the young generation of Indonesian global partners who have supported the Indonesian government efforts to achieve energy self-sufficiency. Andi Romdoni has the details.
Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto Thursday expressed his appreciation for the hard work of all parties, including government officials, national and international private partners, and the young generation of Indonesia who have demonstrated their ability to manage large-scale and complex energy projects. The head of state conveyed this appreciation in his remarks when inaugurating the operation and development of renewable energy in 15 provinces, the increased oil production by 30,000 barrels in the Cepu block, and laying the first stone for 5 geothermal power plants.
Terima kasih saya kepada semua unsur yang telah bekerja keras. Kerjasama kita.
My gratitude to all elements who have worked hard. Our cooperation with our partners from abroad, from the private sector. I am also very happy and proud to see that our young people have played a very active role. Our young engineers, our workers everywhere have been able to manage such sophisticated and complex projects. This really makes me proud. In addition, President Prabowo also appreciated the active role of strategic partners, both from within and outside the country, who have supported national energy development. According to the President, the participation of strategic partners has provided real results and benefits for Indonesia.
You have been loyal to Indonesia, and Indonesia will not forget your loyalty and your participation in our effort to achieve a modern and self-reliant Indonesia. Once again, on behalf of the Indonesian people, I would like to thank you. Pass on my best regards to all your executives.
The inauguration of the operation and development of renewable energy in 15 provinces, an increase in oil production by 30,000 barrels in the Cepu block, and the laying of the first stone for 5 geothermal power plants marks the Indonesian government's commitment to accelerate the national energy transition and achieve the net zero emissions target by 2060. According to Prabowo, in the midst of the global energy transformation, this step shows Indonesia's determination to stand on its own 2 feet and manage energy efficiently and sovereignly for the prosperity of the people.
Coming up next, information about President Prabowo pushes for energy self-sufficiency in villages and remote islands. Ranoff has the details.
Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto emphasized the importance of transitioning to energy self-sufficiency based on clean and efficient national resources. The President is optimistic the solar energy will be key to achieving energy independence across the country, even in remote areas. He expressed this during his speech at the hybrid inauguration of renewable energy operation and project in 15 provinces, the increase in oil production by 30,000 barrels at the Cepu block, and the groundbreaking of 5 geothermal power plants on Thursday, June 26, 2025.
Untuk kita bisa mempercepat pembangunan proyek-proyek yang bisa menghasilkan energi itu.
We can accelerate the development of projects that produce energy, but the most strategic will be renewable energy, especially solar energy. With solar energy, every village can be self-sufficient in energy. Every district can be energy self-sufficient. Every regency can be energy self-sufficient. Even remote islands will have energy and can be self-sufficient. Villages in the mountains can also have access to electricity. This makes us optimistic and gives us a very bright outlook for the future.
Ini sangat membuat kita optimis, membuat kita memandang masa depan dengan sangat cerah.
President Prabowo said Indonesia's ongoing energy transition is not only focused on national energy security but also on cost efficiency, environmental sustainability, and the equitable prosperity of the people. He also called on all parties to work together to achieve the zero carbon emission target on time.
Next info is about President Prabowo inaugurated the operation and development of renewable energy in several regions in Indonesia, an important step to achieve energy in independence. Andi Romdoni has the details.
Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto Thursday inaugurated the operation and development of renewable energy in 15 provinces, increased oil production by 30,000 barrels in the Cepu block, and laid the first stone for 5 geothermal power plant PLTP projects in Indonesia. In his remarks via video conference, President Prabowo emphasized that these projects are important milestone in realizing sustainable national energy independence.
Peresmian pembangunan dan pengoperasian energi terbarukan di 15 provinsi.
The inauguration of the development and operation of renewable energy in 15 provinces and increased oil production by 30,000 barrels in the Cepu block is a very important momentum in our development as a nation. With these programs, with these projects, and of course there are many more big projects that we must implement and will implement. These are all efforts to make our nation self-sufficient in energy.
Swasembada energy.
The head of state also emphasized that energy sovereignty is part of the nation's sovereignty. According to him, Indonesia has extraordinary renewable energy resources and must be managed optimally.
Hari ini kita resmikan.
Today we inaugurated and start the construction of 55 new and renewable energy generators. We inaugurate geothermal power plant as a proof that Indonesia is heading towards independence. We will stand on our own 2 feet and we will be able to provide energy for all Indonesian people in an efficient and economical manner. Meanwhile, the Minister of Energy and Mineral Resources, Bahlil Lahadalia, in his report said that the projects that were inaugurated had a capacity of 379.7 megawatts with an investment value of 25 trillion rupiah. Bahlil also said that with an increase in oil production of 30,000 barrels, the Cepu block currently produces a total lifting of 180,000 barrels per day, equivalent to 25% of the total national lifting.
Our next info is about Minister of Migrant Workers Protection says working abroad officially with proper skills is a pathway to upward mobility. Dora has the details.
Indonesian Minister of Migrant Workers Protection, Abdul Kadir Karding, emphasized that the procedural placement of migrant workers is one of the long-term solutions to tackle unemployment. Speaking at the inauguration of the Migrant Center at Diponegoro University Semarang on Thursday, Karding stated that working abroad officially with proper skill is a pathway to upward mobility. According to Karding, the government through the Ministry of Migrant Workers Protection is not only focusing on the placement of migrant workers but is also initiating a migrant fund to cover training and departure costs.
Kita sedang menggagas migrant fund. Jadi ada dana.
We are initiating a migrant fund which will be managed as a revolving fund by the ministry. It can be borrowed at low interest rate to cover training, document processing and departure expenses.
Skema pelatihan, pengurusan dokumen dan pemberangkatan.
Karin Forer explained that through the migrant fund, prospective migrant worker will also be able to access people business credit or KUR. He added that the government is cooperating with banks to ensure that prospective migrant workers can obtain KUR loans without the needs for collateral.
Last but not least, we have info about government prioritizes drug eradication in development agenda as a strong commitment to developing high-quality Indonesian human resources. Dora Parnede has the details.
Indonesian head of the National Narcotics Agency, Martinus Hukum, stated that President Prabowo's government has designated drugs-related issues as a priority in the national development agenda. Speaking at the commemoration of the International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking held at Sasono Utomo Hall, Taman Mini Indonesia Indah Jakarta on Thursday, Martinus emphasized that this reflects the government's strong commitment to developing high-quality Indonesian human resources in anticipation of the demographic bonus and the Golden Indonesia 2045 vision, as well as a form of political and moral commitment to free Indonesia from the clutches of narcotics crime. As a manifestation of the government's policy, Martinus called on all stakeholders to continue active effort in uncovering drugs, smuggling and trafficking networks and to make preventive and curative efforts.
Sebagai pengejawantahan kebijakan Presiden, kami sebagai Kepala Badan Narkotika Nasional Republik Indonesia menghimbau.
As a realization of the President's policy, we at the National Narcotics Agency urge all related stakeholders to interpret these policies by continuing to take action tirelessly on countering smuggling and drug trafficking cases and collaborating in preventive efforts to build Indonesia's social resilience. Additionally, we must pursue curative efforts, both medically and socially, to restore human dignity among drug users and addicts.
Baik aspek medis maupun aspek sosial untuk mengembalikan nilai-nilai kemanusiaan kepada para penyalahguna dan pecandu narkoba.
Martinus explained that this year's International Day Against Drugs Abuse and Illicit Trafficking adopts the global theme. The evidence is clear: invest in prevention, break the cycle, stop organized crime. According to him, this theme sends a universal message that drug abuse prevention is a long-term investment to nurture a generation that is noble in character, competitive, and excellent. He also emphasized that the team strengthened the alignment of policies, commitments, and global action to break the chains of drug syndicates as part of transnational organized crime by enhancing international cooperation as well as national cross-institutional collaboration.
Well, listener, that was some information that happens in Indonesia this week on Highlight of the Week. Of Indonesia, from Indonesia to the world.
Terima kasih. tanah terindah, berlari mengejar matahari ke arah yang sama. Dan jika kau mempertanyakan arahmu tentang apa yang harus kau cari di tengah ragumu, lihatlah dunia menunggu langkahmu. Keluarlah kau dari batasmu. Sadarkah kau kita hidup di bagian bumi terindah.
RRI Digital with New Look. Various collaborative content from various national programs, including live visual broadcasts, live radio broadcasts, music playlists, podcasts, video news, and various users' interaction features in the game. Various interesting content such as likes, comments, and shares, as well as live chat with broadcasters and users. Direct messaging and private chat facilities between app users are also available. RRI Digital. Available on Google Store and App Store. RRI Digital.
Indonesia is coming up shortly. Stay tuned with us, Voice of Indonesia.
Welcome back, listener, and thank you for staying tuned in Indonesia today. Listener, recent conflict that has been escalating day by day in Gaza give many horrible terror for anybody who experience it. Humna El-Sayed is an Al Jazeera journalist station in Gaza will share her experience on VOI Talk, hosted by Daniel.
Voice of Indonesia.
Welcome to special interview on Voice of Indonesia. I'm Daniel. It's an honor to welcome our special guest, Humna El-Sayed, a respected Al Jazeera journalist who has fearlessly reported from Gaza. In the midst of danger and escalating crisis, she brings forward voices and stories the world needs and should listen to. Thank you, Humna. Thank you for coming and being with us today.
Thank you so much, Daniel, for hosting me. It's truly a pleasure to be here among you guys in Indonesia and in Radio Republic of Indonesia.
Well, let's start with what you are seeing on the ground right now. How would you describe the situation in Gaza after 2 years of the ongoing Israeli aggression and its indiscriminate attack?
Well, since day one, honestly, Daniel, since this genocide started unfolding, the situation in Gaza has been deteriorating day after day. Let's not forget that prior to the 7th of October, Gaza has already been living under a lasting Israeli siege for the past 18 years, which means that Gaza is not a place for supplies and goods and products that are found everywhere in the markets, for example. We did not have electricity like other places around the world. We did not have enough fuel. At best case scenarios, it was 8 hours of electricity, which meant that hospitals were depending on generators, on fuels. We had only one sole company of electricity that was barely running, you know, and Israel had refused for many years to allow the Palestinians in Gaza to have a real, you know, a supplier of electricity in Gaza. It means that Gaza is not a place that had water that is always running. The health sector in Gaza was always on the verge of collapse. In any kind of emergency that had happened or would happen instantly, that verge of collapse instantly collapsed. At the beginning of the genocide, I remember I was asking one of the head of the emergency section in Al-Shifa Hospital, and I said, how much is the capacity of beds around across the strip in the hospitals? You know how many he told me?
How many?
1,800 medical beds across the strip. The strip is a home for 2.3 million people. We're talking about 1,800 medical beds. That's less than 2,000 beds. Can you imagine? This is basically the reality of Gaza before any kind of war or escalation. But this same, and this is a situation, by the way, that international organizations are aware of. They know that this is the reality of the situation in Gaza. The international community understands very much the reality of the situation in Gaza, and they know that this, all these measures, precautions, denials, are because of an illegal Israeli occupation and siege on the Gaza Strip. For almost 2 years now, the people in Gaza are being bombed indiscriminately, day and night, relentlessly. Forced evacuations, forced displacement. Children are dying of starvation while the entire world is watching.
Yeah.
Children, women, men, elderly are dying of thirst. They go through the process of being tortured by your veins drying because of your thirst. That all this All this is being allowed while the entire world is watching. It's being documented while the international community is allowing it to happen.
And you saw those realities by yourself on the ground.
I lived this reality. I lived this reality, Daniel, with my children. I lived this reality with my neighbors, with the people around me. I've seen it. I've lived it. I know how much the amount of suffering and torment that these people live on a daily basis, not just on a daily basis, every hour of every day.
Yumna, the footage of the missiles striking the building just behind you while you were reporting from Gaza left everybody in shock. And I personally admire your courage to continuing the reporting in such horrifying and terrible situations. So could you share with us about that horrible experience and what gave you the courage to carry on in such a dangerous situation?
It's very ironic because this happened in the 7th of October 2023, but in May 2021, a similar video and a similar situation happened to me also while I was on air. Only this time the tower that was hit was right in front of me. So the audience and the camera was not capturing the targeting of the tower. It was capturing my reaction. And this just, I'm just giving you an example of something that happened in 2021 and it happened again in 2023. This is just really the reality of
kind of deja vu.
The coverage that, or the kind of work that we live as Palestinian journalists in the field.
Yes.
I was just by coincidence that it happened while I was live on air and the entire world had seen it.
Yes.
It has happened with a lot of other, maybe not the same situation exactly, but many other situations like this situation or similar to this situation have happened with so many other colleagues. And the cameras, because they were not live, did not capture that situation. It has happened with me in so many other situations that were much worse than this one. I actually felt after I've been subjected to other situations of live bombardment, that this one was actually the lightest of them all.
Yeah. And there's still injury on your shoulder, right?
It was actually the shrapnel flying. I did not get an injury from that day. No, the injury I have in my back is because of my my very heavy vest and helmet. And another situation that happened in Jabalia refugee camp, when a massacre. I went to cover a massacre in Jabalia refugee camp, and suddenly the Israeli army called to say that it was going to hit again the same place that was struck, and it was a total chaos, and everyone started running for their life, and they actually hit before people had moved out of the place, and I was one of these people as well. So it's just a lot of situations that you can't really take your breath in the field when you're covering a war or a genocide in Gaza. And this one has been completely different. Everyone used to ask me at the beginning, why is this one different than other wars? And I used to think, because of course this one is so much more fearful, this one has no rules, journalists were declared as legitimate targets. No, it's every single Palestinian in Gaza was declared as a legitimate target. But then I realized all the previous ones, Daniel, were wars. This one is a genocide. It's a genocide from the very first beginning.
Second day, right?
From the very first day. That tower that was captured on live on camera, it's a 14-story building residential tower right in the middle of Gaza City. And maybe what kept me going is that Gaza is a very small place. We know the names of the buildings, the areas, the streets, everything. So it was easy to look and to identify right away the residential tower that was hit. But of course, I was in a state of panic. I was in a state of terror. I'm at the end, I'm a human being. I can't neglect the, really, it's just like the normal human reaction that you can't control as a human being.
So what gave you the courage to carry on? You're still reporting under that dangerous situation. And in your opinion, I mean, from your perspective, what brings about the courage and what makes Palestinian journalists so brave? Yeah.
Well, I feel that we carry on not just as a professional duty. We carry on because of the ethical and moral duty and responsibility that we carry on our shoulders as Palestinian journalists covering a genocide that is unfolding against our own people. I always said that the journalist is not the story, and we know that as journalists. We always say that it's not the journalist behind the story that matters. But in this case, every single journalist was living the same story. He and she were living the story of their homes being bombed, their families being threatened, their neighborhoods being destroyed, their streets, their schools, their everything, their entire lives. So it's not that we have been excluded. No, it got to the point where we are being targeted, and so are our family, for being journalists. And this is where all lines have been crossed. We have been put in a total different category, treated as criminals, and that we must be targeted for our coverage, for being the window of the world on the atrocities and crimes committed by the Israeli army towards innocent civilians.
Even though they are protected by law, right? Even though they are protected by law.
Every single civilian is protected under international law. And journalists are civilians that are identified. They risk their lives to go to places of danger to report, to become the window, the messenger of truth for the rest of the world. And this should give them a sense of protection and appreciation for risking their lives and not just staying home at such dangerous times.
Yeah. Yumna, allow me to briefly take a step back into the past. What first brought you to be a war journalist in Gaza?
So I became a journalist at first. Being a war journalist was actually imposed on me because this is just the reality and the case for every journalist in Gaza. Journalism has always been a passion for me. It was not part of my academic background or education. It was a dream and a passion that I really wanted to pursue one day. Gaza, after I moved there to settle completely in 2014, was a place for me that I realized that the world doesn't know anything about. It's an impoverished territory under lasting Israeli occupation, going through dozens of escalations, military escalations, and wars year after year. It was nobody knew anything or heard anything about Gaza except at these very difficult times and tough times. But nobody knew anything about the beautiful faces of Gaza, the people of Gaza, the culture of Gaza. And I thought that this is where I can really start pursuing my dream and and taking that step that I've always wanted and postponed it. And that's when I started learning how to become a journalist. And I think each and every journalist have, we all have the general standards and principles of journalism, the code of ethics that we hear about, that we read about. But each and every journalist is distinguished by their own principles, yes, standards, sure, and not experience and capabilities, because that differs from journalist to another, of course. And of course, it distinguishes journalists. But I think that the integrity, the standards, and the principles are the most important that distinguish true journalists today.
Yeah, Yuna, being or a journalist, putting life at risk, so line of works, yeah, can be tough on your family. How did your father, your mother, or family react when you decided to become a war journalist, to become a journalist in a very conflict zone, so the most dangerous area maybe on the globe?
Well, it was not easy, and it's still not easy until now. And the fact that they always feel that I'm not safe out there in the field, even when I used to go to cover the marches and the protests by the borders, we as journalists used to get targeted by the Israeli army deployed on the other side of the security fence, although we are hundreds of meters away from it. And this has always been a sense of worry, and just not just among my family, but among my family, my friends, everyone who knows me. But at the same time, it's an important duty in a place like Gaza, well, Daniel, because I report in English.
Yes.
And I report for a special kind of audience. I report for the international audience, for the Western audience. Western. That, for me as Yumna, I need those audiences away from the Middle East, on the other parts of the world, to realize what is happening in Gaza, to realize the injustice that we are living, especially that we live in a time where the Israeli propaganda,
yes,
is very strong and very influential. Yes. And as a journalist, I don't see a reason for you not to go by yourself to the place, to the territory, and investigate,
yes,
and witness firsthand. Because a part of a journalist's definition is not just a messenger, but a witness, a firsthand witness. Many journalists can, with many nationalities, they can go to the occupied territories, they can go to occupied East Jerusalem, they can even access the Gaza Strip and come. Of course, not during this genocide, but before. And they can go and see and witness for themselves.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But we're talking about long years, decades. Of oppression, suppression, illegal occupation, lasting blockade. You can't have all these injustices unfold year after another towards a population and be completely silent and quiet about, and then wake up and realize that, oh, there's the 7th of October attack and the entire world is talking about it.
Yeah.
And the decades of suffering and oppression and repression and siege and slaughter against an entire population in the occupied Palestinian territories, in East Jerusalem, and in the Gaza Strip, all are summarized in one attack called the October 7th attack. The October 7th attack is an attack. It happened. You cannot have double standards and say, oh, I do not sympathize with what happened. No, that is just having the same double standards that I condemn and denounce. A victim is a victim everywhere. no matter on this side of the border or that side of the border. A civilian is a civilian, no matter their nationality, Palestinians and Israelis. But you can't unsee and ignore and turn a blind eye and a deaf ear towards all these injustices unfolding for decades against the Palestinian people, and then come and focus on one attack by the Palestinian groups or a certain group, okay?
Yes.
And then watch an entire genocide unfold against innocent civilians, collective punishment by all means, and stay silent and quiet about how is that justified?
Yes.
It is not justified.
Not justified at all. Yeah. Yumna, covering war means witnessing human suffering. So maybe many of your journalists wonder, how do you manage yourself, your psychological well-being, to do your job under such extreme condition?
Well, I have a very horrible psychological well-being. And I don't think...
Because many journalists, of course, Indonesian journalists wonder, how can you be that's wrong. So how you manage your psychological well-being?
Well, to be honest with you, I find ways to survive, but I don't have a well mental condition since I came out of Gaza. For example, I have sleep deprivation for over a year now. And makeup and concealers, you would constantly be seeing very dark circles around my eyes. And this is something that I can't control, because no matter how much I try to go to sleep, I can't sleep.
So how many hours do you sleep every night?
I try to, if I can get 2 or 3 hours of sleep, I'm very happy. I'm very grateful. Yeah. I sleep when I completely fall asleep alone, because I can't take it anymore. The well-being of a person who has witnessed such scenes, pictures, events, not just with people around me in Gaza, but even among my children,
yes,
as a mother,
your daughter,
is not something that I think I can ever recover from.
Yeah.
And maybe there was hope that I would have recovered if the genocide would have stopped long ago, and we would have seen some better, you know, better days unfolding for thousands of children. Mm. I think about those children who are only survivors, those children who are starving, those children who are thirsty, those children who are suffering in hospitals of third degree.